And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change. Just a programming note that this is the second part of a two-part conversation I had with the Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon. Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon is the Executive Director of Churches for Middle East Peace and an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Covenant Church. Cannon holds an MDiv from North Park Theological Seminary, an MBA from North Park University School of Business and Nonprofit Management, and an MA in Bioethics from Trinity International University. She received her first doctorate in American history with a minor in Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Davis, focusing on the history of the American Protestant Church in Israel-Palestine, and her second doctorate in ministry and spiritual formation from Northern Theological Seminary. And as is our custom, we will provide any web links that we discuss in this conversation in the programming notes and on the blog bendersoftheark.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, I guess, you know, oftentimes governments take up arms, military interventions, because they say that there's an existential threat, that they have no choice. But I've been wondering what the impact of these military adventurism, whether it's by the U.S. or others, what the impact of that is on minority religious communities. And I'm thinking here of the Christian community in Palestine, but also thinking of the impact on Jewish and Christian populations in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, and other places where the brutality of these military interventions really has had a negative impact. I don't know if you have any insight into what the impact is for religious minorities like Christians. I mean, Christians are a dwindling minority in Palestine, as I understand, and in Israel. Can you give us a sense of what that impact is?
Sure. And I can speak to the Christian community in the Palestinian territories, in Israel and in the broader Middle East. I will be traveling to the Middle East next week to multiple countries, and we'll have a much better idea when I return about how those communities and other minority groups, Yazidis, Jewish groups, et cetera, and others are doing in that broader context. But I know prior to October 7th in Gaza, the population of Christians was less than 1,000 people. And so we wrote a letter, a statement that was also a letter to the White House. And we've been in conversation with them because we have a concern that the Christian community could be exterminated completely as a result of Israel's bombing campaign and ground invasion. The first major attack that affected the Christian community was the bombing of the Orthodox Church, St. Porphyrius. There were, I believe the number killed was 18 people, 17 or 18 people were killed in that attack. There have been, there was an attack on the Ali Hospital, which is an Anglican hospital. That was on the 14th. That Israel did claim that was before the large attack that went international, that then caught all the news about, was it an errant rocket from militant groups or was it an Israeli attack? That second bombing that affected the Ali Hospital, killed a larger number of people. Most of those were not Christians. Those were refugees that were in the parking lot at A'ali. But we know that at least 24 Christians of that 1,000 population have died, if not more than that. And so the population, when you're only starting with 1,000 people, has already been significantly affected. In addition to that, while the world is paying attention to what's happening in Gaza, you're having a crisis with the Christian community in the old city of Jerusalem. There is a major battle going on in the Armenian quarter, where about 25% of the land is being contested. There was a land sale that is being protested by the patriarch that the Israeli government is not acknowledging. I think that they're honoring the land sale that was done by a priest who didn't have the authority, and settlers are trying to take over the land. And so now the Armenian community has not agreed to it. And so the Armenian community is actually camping out on the property so that this parking lot cannot be turned into, my understanding is it would be it's an Armenian Christian community that would be turned into a Jewish settlement. And so that's a community I'll be meeting with, I believe, in the next few weeks. You know, so the Christian community in the occupied Palestinian territories, East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza, is under significant threat. And it's not because of Muslim persecution. It's because of the realities of war and conflict. The community, specifically in the West Bank, is at less than 1%. You know, they're devastated, and they are some of the loudest voices saying, where is the Western church? And why are Christians not crying out on our behalf? Why are our brothers and sisters in Christ not lamenting with us, not visiting us, not praying for us? And so there have been letters, you know, from that community. We just hosted a service with Munther Itzhak on December 23rd called Christ in the Rubble, talking about God's solidarity, you know, with the people in Gaza. The Christian community in Israel has been growing, actually. There are Palestinian Christians in Israel and also Messianic Jews, Jewish converts to Christianity. So that reality looks a little different. But of course, all Palestinians, even Palestinian citizens of Israel right now, are going through a very hard time. There is very little, if any, room for solidarity with Gaza at all. We heard from human rights groups that even Jewish Israelis were being threatened to be put on buses and shipped to Gaza if they supported the Palestinian cause in Gaza, for example.
Yeah, I've heard reports of Palestinian Israelis losing their jobs, being forced out of their homes. And then in the West Bank, I've heard that the intimidation and even, you know, forcible removal from homes, threats and such has just escalated beyond measure. And I guess part of this is so frustrating that our tax dollars are going to fund this kind of violence. You know, we know that we have a crisis of violence on our streets because of the proliferation of weapons. And so the U.S. And U.S. arms manufacturers are spreading this around the world. So we kind of think, well, this is what could possibly go wrong. Mm-hmm. Just look at our own society and the trouble that we are having with mass shootings and with people taking the law into their own hands. It's such a grievous problem. And I don't know how we get out of this, but I guess, what is it that I know that you're saying that we need to
stand in the gap, give, act, and pray.
Okay, thank you. So what does that actually mean? What are you calling on churches to do? What should we be doing in our congregations?
Yes. Well, and I think churches, you know, we use give, act, and pray as kind of an individual mobilization tool. I mean, certainly churches can do that as well. Churches and groups of people, I think there are so many more things that we can do. I think some of it is just creating space for a conversation. So learning, you know, I mean, I prior to working on the Middle East, you know, you went through my degrees. I was so well educated. I was just starting to work on my first PhD, but I had 3 master's degree. My first book was coming out. And, you know, so I was fairly well educated the very first time I went to the Holy Land. And I traveled across the Allenby Bridge, and the border patrol agent, an Israeli, said to me, "Are you going to the West Bank?" Now, Jeff, I was in the West Bank. Now, I didn't know I was in the West Bank. I didn't know anything about the Middle East. You know, I was a pastor. You know, I had studied ethics. I'd studied theology. I'd studied business. You know, I was doing a PhD on the role of religion in domestic social reform. I was studying Martin Luther King. I didn't know anything about Palestine. And they said, "Are you going to the West Bank?" And I was so ignorant. I said no, even though I was in the West Bank. And I think about how myself as an educated individual didn't even know a map. I mean, I didn't know. I thought Palestine was a map in the back of my Bible, not that the Palestinian people were a people struggling for self-determination, you know, since 1948. And so Churches for Middle East Peace, one of my commitments this past fall, I traveled 8 weeks over the last 3 months. I preached almost every Sunday. We have scholars from Harvard. We have people with PhDs. We have pastors. You know, we have different denominational leaders. We'll come. I mean, I don't want to say we'll come to anyone who asks, but our goal is to speak as many places as we can, just to help communities understand, either virtually or, you know, in person, to be able to learn history, theology, how did we get to this place? And a lot of times I'll speak to communities and they'll have facts and statistics and information, but honestly, it's from the 80s and 90s, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say, "Well, the Palestinian Authority never accepted Israel's right to exist." Well, that's not true. Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, you know, signed the Oslo Peace Accords, and one of the presuppositions was accepting Israel's right to exist in the early 90s, right? And so we're operating on these presuppositions that are decades old. And it was good information back then, but it's not now, which is one of the reasons why I do these 10-minute videos every day. And so I am not trying to be a voice, but I can consolidate data from Jewish sources, you know, from, you know, Arab news sources. You know, we're in touch, of course, with the White House, the State Department, U.S. government officials. So trying to just say in 10 minutes or less, let me consolidate. Here's the most important things you need to know about what's happening related to this issue. And so the educational opportunities for groups, you know, doing book studies. We have a book that is an edited volume called A Land Full of God. It was really written for evangelicals. A third of the chapters are pro-Israel. A third of the chapters are pro-Palestinian. Archbishop Desmond Tutu gave us a chapter called Apartheid before he passed. Mm-hmm. A third of the chapters are seeking to kind of differentiate. You know, it talks about history, it talks about theology. Like, that's a great starting point if people are like, "Wait a minute," you know, because it looks at, if you don't kind of know where to start, I feel like that book, we edited it to be a great starting point. So we're not trying to silence any voice. But if you want to know what pro-Israel Christian Zionists think, you know, Susan Michael, the head of the U.S., or at least formerly, she was the head of the U.S. International Christian Embassy, one of the leading Christian Zionist organizations. She has a chapter. The chapters are very short. And she says, "Stand with Israel or else you're not standing on the side of God," which, just for the record, is what the editor of Christianity Today said at the beginning of all of this. You know, and I wrote a response in Religious News Services and said, you know, I believe God calls us to stand with people and not to stand with states. Mm-hmm. And so, but we're not trying to limit information to tell people how to think. We're trying to give them information so that they can make well-informed decisions and choices.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so important. Thank you for that work that you're doing about this. You know, in the Presbyterian Church, we struggled with this mightily. I think, I want to say it was in 2004, the General Assembly voted to divest from companies that were supporting the occupation. And then there was a huge backlash Many folks in the Jewish community and even pastors of Presbyterian churches were calling us anti-Semitic. And so we went through a kind of a dark night of the soul there, and that I think was a good reckoning, a good taking time to really look and see, what are we about here? Are we being anti-Semitic when we stand up for our values? And I have to give great credit to the young people of Jewish Voice for Peace, who walked the halls of many of our General Assemblies throughout the years, saying another Jew for divestment, and reminding us that standing up for our values is not anti-Semitic. And so that was very powerful. And I still just feel so grateful that they were there to help us make that case.
Go ahead. Well, just in response to that, I think, our denominations are at such different places, and some are very conservative, some are very liberal. Theologically, they're at different places, but our denominations came together and said, we are committed to positively engage in the right to support economic measures to pursue justice and human rights. And so CMEP is officially neutral on the issue of BDS, but some of our groups like the PCUSA are leading the way on calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Some of our communities call for a boycott, but specifically of settlement products, products made in the occupied Palestinian territories. And so our groups have diverse perspectives, but have really supported us and unanimously agreed, you know, even the right to engage in boycott, divestment, and sanctions has been threatened in the United States in past years. Yeah. And so we've been very ardently advocating for that right to be protected, which I think is critically, critically important. And I wish, Jeff, that all people knew, when I learned that before the PCUSA divested, that there was a 10-year process of going to the corporations directly, there was a behind-the-scenes process, there was so much diligence that I thought was really, really impressive, that this was not just a flash-in-the-pan decision. And I also appreciate, I mean, we are committed to standing against anti-Muslim, you know, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian actions and standing against bigotry. And so those tension points of how do we do what we do well while being attentive to honoring, you know, all communities, I think are really critical questions.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. The Presbyterian Church has struggled with it and finally came out in support of divestment of the companies that were supporting the occupation, as well as BDS. That was, and it took a lot of soul searching, a lot of conversation, a lot of debate for us to get there. And that process is ongoing because, you know, those recommendations, at least the ones that are not specifically about divestment, but those that are encouraging churches to consider BDS and other actions are advisory. It's not required. And so there's a lot of work yet to do on that. Do you have programs set up to allow churches to travel? And what are those like?
We do, and we would love for churches to travel with us or to travel in general on trips that don't only see, you know, holy sites. But we encourage, you know, many, many churches will do traditional pilgrimages. And even if it's just call us and we'll set up a meeting for you with local leaders, right? Or local Palestinian Christians, or we also do multi-narrative tours. We talk about what does it mean to be multi-narrative and to hear from Jewish voices and Palestinian voices. And one of the things we really try to talk about is, you know, the Jewish perspective is not monolithic. I mean, there are Jewish human rights activists. I mean, there are, you know, so many different Jewish perspectives. And so getting away from these false binaries, I think, is so helpful. Just the way that Palestinian perspectives are not monolithic, which I think is really important to understand. So we do traditional spiritual pilgrimages and Bible tours and things like that, but we also do tours that are just geopolitical, that are, and we also have curriculums that are theological, you know, or are an introduction to the history of the conflict or the geopolitics of the conflict.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I guess, is there anything else that you really want us to know? I mean, what is the most important thing that you have to tell folks that are new to this and to the churches? I know give, act, and pray. Is there anything else that you want us specifically to know?
Thank you for that question. I think my response is twofold. One, an invitation to a transformational journey that while all of us may not be called to the Middle East, I believe if we open our hearts and allow them to be broken for what's happening right now, for what's happening in Gaza, for the way that people who have experienced violence as a result of the occupation or the campaign against Gaza right now, or even the hostages, or even what happened on October 7th, if we allow our hearts to be broken and to enter into learning about this conflict, it will teach us more than we can ever know. It is a transformational journey. You know, the whole idea that Jesus calls us not only to love our neighbor, but to love our enemy. I never had enemies before I started working on the Middle East. And if you are committed to peace, I promise you, you will have people who you might not see them as your enemy, but they will identify you as theirs. And learning how to love and be at peace and to honor God in the midst of that space is transformational. And that's an invitation. The other encouragement that I have is really an exhortation. And this is a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He says, "Silence in the face of evil is evil itself. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak, and not to act is to act." And in this moment, my great fear is that genocide is happening on our watch. And in large part, we are being silent about it. And we have the obligation to not be silent.
Was it Dr. King who said, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal"? And so I think at this time, it's important that we not betray those who are suffering in this. Well, May, I want to thank you so much for your work and for what you're doing, for the heart and passion that you bring to this work. And it's a great pleasure to share this time with you. And thank you so much for all that you're doing. Let's stay in touch and see how we can continue to spread the good news.
I would welcome that. And thank you for your personal sacrifice. I appreciate the stories that you shared.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people. Mm-hmm.